Hey, happy Friday. We made it to Friday. We made it to the second last show, the what show?
Penultimate.
Penultimate. What a penultimate. Great word.
Great vocab word.
Get your thesaurus
means
out.
Second to last.
Sure does. Second to last show. Raptors will clean out their lockers on Monday. We'll be with you to break that down and send you into the offseason. Today, we're going to, well, the Raptors still have two games left. They got the Mavs and the Spurs. The games don't matter for lottery seeding, which is nice. The Raptors are locked into seventh, which means a 7.5% chance at the number one pick, a 31.9% chance at picking in the top four, and yeah, about a 50-50 chance of picking eighth or later. May 12th, circle it on
your
calendar.
Can we edit out that last part?
Yeah.
Let's not focus on that.
Yeah, learn probabilities. They're not friendly. We have a lot of stuff to talk. Tim Cato is going to join us. He was at Luka's return to Dallas the other night, and the Raptors are in Dallas tonight. So in the second half of the show, we'll go through all that, set you up. Dallas also fighting for playoff positioning here as the NBA heads into a final weekend that they've got to be pretty happy with. The top seeds are established. Cleveland's locked in. Boston's locked in. Oklahoma City's locked in. And Houston's locked in. Otherwise, though, all the seeds 3-10, they're still jockeying, if not to avoid the play-in, then to host the play-in, home court advantage in the first round and things like that. The Pacers locked that up last night. League's got to be pretty happy with how much actually matters tonight through Sunday.
I agree. And think of the pressure on these games. Like, there's a huge difference between getting a top six seed guaranteed to be in the playoffs versus having to go into the play-in tournament, which is very unpredictable. Mm. But is what makes it entertaining and is why they, one of the reasons why they did it. It's fun. Like, win or go home.
Yeah, it's a blast. So if you're, you know, Dallas tonight, you're still trying to fight. So you're 10th, you're guaranteed a play-in spot, but you'd much rather host that 9-10 game than go on the road to Sacramento. Because if you go on the road, even if you win, then you got to go travel again. You're
That's
playing,
right.
They're trying to light the beam on you and stuff like that. And then the West is crazy. Like, we talked about it a little bit yesterday, but 3 through 8 in the West is still only separated by two games, with every team having two games left to go. So a lot can happen there. We'll talk some of that. We'll start our Raptors end of season thoughts, which I guess we did a little bit the other day, talking about the young guys and the positives from this season. But we have a couple of non-Raptors, non-Mavericks things to check off. And the first of those, Matt, and I know you want to talk a little bit about Bright Eyes, the concert you saw last night, an artist both of us really like. But you have multiple days in a row now brought up LeBron's Barbie. So I just want to give you a little bit of space to show your appreciation for the LeBron James Barbie, or I guess Ken doll. What are your thoughts on it? You brought it up 2 days in a row before the show. I feel like we should talk about it on air.
It's just an incredible cultural crossover.
Yeah.
You have, you know, arguably the greatest player of all time. People will argue Russell. People will argue Jordan, obviously. I'm on Team Jordan personally. But you have him combined with one of the most famous toy ever, mm-hmm. Barbie. I want, you know, the Barbie movie was a huge hit. You got to think they're making a sequel.
Yeah.
It made so much money.
This is the thing.
So now the question is LeBron going to be in that sequel with like Simu Liu and like doing the dances and the songs?
Yeah, or does
that
LeBron,
would be hilarious.
Or has LeBron had enough of sequels after his version of Space Jam? Although it did well enough, it was not particularly well received by people of our age who like hold the original Space Jam in such high esteem. Apparently kids loved it. I don't know. Did your kids watch Space Jam too?
Yeah, they liked it. Yeah. It was fine. The bottom line is, does it make money?
Yeah.
Everything's a business.
And this is where the Barbie one gets interesting, not from a like LeBron perspective, but you have Greta do the script and direct it and stuff like that, and you get these big name actors. Are they willing to run it back for a sequel that is not as like part of the reason the Barbie movie was so successful is that it was actually like a good, like a, as far as corporate tie-in movies go, is actually like a fairly good movie. So can you replicate that, or would the second one just be a cash grab? And if it's just
it's a cash grab. Every second one is a cash grab.
Do you lose some of the top people involved?
Unless it's like a continuation of a story like Star Wars or Matrix or like one of those types of movies. Every sequel is a cash grab.
Yeah.
Like Dumb and Dumberer.
Yeah. That's an awful one. Zoolander 2. Like
very
those are the
few of them
really
were
bad ones.
Like Anchorman 2 was really good. That's one that worked.
I have no recollection of Anchorman 2.
You need to watch it.
Okay.
It's very good.
James Marsden is the bad guy, right?
Yeah. The writing, the dialogue, the comedy, okay. They like were able to kind of like nail everything.
Okay.
Where most especially for a comedy, most sequels don't. I like all the Austin Powers sequels too, actually.
The second one's good. A Goldmember less so.
I think they're all funny. Okay. Mike Myers kills me.
Yeah. And you can nail a good sequel. Something like, I don't know, Toy Story 2, Godfather 2.
I don't know if I count kids movies.
Yeah, I guess it's easy. But like Toy Story 2, I think is like held up as like one of the better as far as kids movies go.
But in Godfather is a continuation on the story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, one of the best movies of all time. So it's, you can get some good sequels. Like the sequel to Major League is pretty good. Major League 2, as far as those things go. I don't know.
I guess there's so many horrible sequels. Yeah. It sullies the image of sequels.
I think the Horrible Bosses sequel, now that you use the word horrible, I think the Horrible Bosses sequel.
I've never seen that one.
Okay.
I liked Horrible Bosses 1. All right. Anyways, back to Bright Eyes.
Yeah, so you saw Bright Eyes at History last night with Cursive, which is, that's a great lineup.
Yeah, that's like my heyday of indie rock, mid-2000s. So it was awesome. First time I saw Bright Eyes was in 2007 in Denver while we were playing the Nuggets in the playoffs when I was on the Spurs on an off night.
You did a playoff off? I guess like sleep schedule-wise, you're still up the same lateness as an after game.
It was at like an upscale theater. So, like, I sat down. The concert was from, like, 8 to 10.
Nice.
And then I went home. So.
I guess, on a playoff game, the tip time's probably, like, 8 o'clock because, like national TV and stuff like that. So you probably don't get to bed till like, 12:30 or 1 on the night of a playoff game anyway?
Exactly. It didn't affect my sleep schedule at all. And I went by myself. I couldn't find anyone else to go with me, which I'm sure shocks everybody. The only NBA guy.
Going to Bright Eyes?
Going to Bright Eyes in 07, too. No less. So I got to see him. Your friend said he loved the set list.
Yeah, I had a couple friends there, and one friend texted me how good the set list, or how happy they were with the set list.
I was not happy with the set list. I thought
not
they
enough.
Left,
I'm wide awake. It's morning.
No, I thought they left a lot on the table for what I wanted to hear, like their older stuff from back when I listened. Granted, they went on a huge hiatus. I'm guessing rehab. I don't know. I don't want to speak ill of Connor Oberst, but he's had his issues, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, you can listen to the lyrics and pick up some of it.
Yeah, but I thought, you know, I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning. That's their iTunes Essential album. Everyone knows I'm obsessed with iTunes Essential albums, the selection, who has what. That's their one. They played four songs off it. However, the two main songs I really wanted to hear, they did do Landlocked Blues last song, which I really wanted to hear, but I really wanted to hear Poison Oak and Road to Joy, and they didn't play them, so that was disappointing. I went on another iTunes Essentials deep dive, and this is shocking to me. Outkast, Aquemini. Have you listened to that album?
Of course.
Amazing album, right? Not an iTunes Essential album.
Huh.
Which really hurts the credibility of the panel over at Apple that selects these things.
I assume they have several, though, right? Like Stankonia and ATLians?
No, those aren't on it either. Maybe Stankonia. They have one. I think they have one.
It's probably Stankonia if they only have one. But
yeah, I would use that in my... Like, if I submitted a resume to be on the panel that selects iTunes Essential Albums, I would put that on my resume. Like, you don't have Outkast, Aquemini as an essential album. Whoever is in charge of this needs to be replaced, because that's insane. I did another deep dive. David Bowie has 9. Bob Dylan has 9. Beatles have 8. If you combine, like, John Lennon, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, and Paul McCartney's solo stuff, like, the Beatles by far, more than anyone, if you count that. Dolly Parton has 8. Rush has 6, which I thought was a lot.
The Holy Triumvirate.
Rolling Stones only have 6. The one that has the most, and it was a Reddit thread, so I didn't find it on my own organically, which I don't like. It's like when I'm hunting for records. Like, I don't just go on eBay and buy it. I have to find it in the record shop, but it doesn't count. So this one doesn't really count. But the one with the most that I found, A.R. Rahman, like a Bollywood Indian artist, 10 iTunes Essential albums. Anyways, good if anyone out there, if you're bored, just it's fun looking up, like trying to find the people with the most essential albums. All right, yeah. So Outkast, Speaker Box, The Love Below, and Stankonia. Okay. Only 2 essential albums.
Okay. I mean, Stankonia is a good choice for one, but...
Yeah, but Aquemini's their best album.
Yeah, and I would put ATLians ahead of Speaker Box, Love Below. as well. Although
I would too.
At my age, like Speakerbox Love Below is the one they had like the most hit music videos for, probably.
Yeah, on the pop radio.
Yeah,
definitely the most.
Yeah, the what's the West Side Story video for Roses.
Yep, Roses. Really good. Hey, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyways. I'm done with my
a good concert iTunes other essentials. Than the
great okay. concert. They performed really well. Connor Oberst, interesting stage presence. He's a kind of a weird dude, a true artist.
Yeah.
It was fun watching him up there.
Yeah, a guy with good side projects too. You mentioned the Beatles side projects. So Connor Oberst has Desaparecidos as well, and then Better Oblivion Community Center, his collab with
Phoebe and Bridges Monsters of Folk.
Yeah, I don't know that one.
That's a super band. I forget who else was in that, but like got people you would know from other well-known bands.
Nice.
It's like three or four of them. I saw him at ACL once perform. He also apologized to Canada on behalf of the United States, which I thought was cool.
Great. Great. Okay. Let's do a little bit of basketball talk.
Okay.
If you're, if we're good. So there was fun basketball last night. You were obviously at the concert. The Pacers locked up home court by beating a shorthanded Cleveland team. We got a big Anthony Edwards game as Minnesota and Memphis jockey for position to make that West picture even murkier. I mentioned it earlier, the 3-8 seeds, but 6, 7, and 8 are all tied right now with 2 games left after Minnesota beat Memphis last night. So a lot popping there. On the Raptors side, they didn't play. However, as I kind of gave the heads up to everyone on the show yesterday, they did waive Cole Swider. They also waived Orlando Robinson. So same idea as Cole Swider. Both of those guys were on rest of season contracts. They still get their money for these last 4 days of the season. But what it does is that the Raptors have just enough money under luxury tax, eat that money, and then sign 2 guys to rest of season plus a year for next year, whether that's a team option or a partial guarantee so that they're in the system for summer league and into training camp and stuff like that. We'll see. And of the options there, you could convert AJ Lawson on his 2-way to a standard deal because otherwise he'd be a free agent. You could sign Cole Swider or Orlando Robinson back to that kind of deal. Colin Castleton's 10-day with the 76ers expires on Saturday. If you wanted to get another one more,
you'd be devastated.
What's that?
You'd be devastated, wouldn't you? If it was Castleton instead over of Robinson.
I'm just happy my actual guy.
I mean, think of the money you lose on the commission.
Yeah. Well, no, I said, he gets his money. He
no, but I
money.
Mean, if they signed him yeah. moving forward.
Yeah. No, so I got asked this a bunch on Twitter. I think it came up on the show yesterday. But the reason I'm not mentioning Jared Roden in with these guys is Jared Roden already is under contract for next year. So my actual guy is already taken care of on a 2-way for next year. So yeah, the Raptors, the other component of this, and I don't know if you have a lean between like Swider, Lawson, Robinson, Castleton, who you'd want a longer look at from that group. Do you? Like, did you like I would assume it's going to be one of Lawson or Swider and one of Castleton or Robinson just for positional balance. Did you like one of those guys better than the other given the window we got into them?
Man, you're putting me on the spot here.
We're splitting hairs. We're talking about a potential, hey, could you make the roster as a third center next year?
I mean, Swider and Lawson are both interesting to me. Yeah. I think Lawson is like just an explosive, could be an explosive fire spark plug off the bench. You know, he can score in a hurry, plays really hard. Swider, you can always use shooting.
Yeah.
We talked about how his shooting hasn't really translated when he gets the chance in the NBA, but it was starting to come around here these last few games.
Yeah, 36% over his time with the Raptors.
He's got to figure out the defense stuff, mm-hmm. kind of like Jamison Battle. Jamison Battle did. He's way better than he was, and he that's his mindset. Cole Swider, I think, needs the same thing, just be able to lock in more on defense. It's tough. It's so hard when you play the three in this league. The guys you have to guard, it's ridiculous. It's really hard. Like, I acknowledge that. So that would be my one question mark with him. If he can get somewhat respectable on defense, I always add more shooting, especially with the roster we have. It's not like we have a ton of it, you know? So
yeah, and he's got size, too. Like, he's 6'8". He doesn't miss many shots, but...
Right. He's got good size.
And then, yeah, I guess between Castleton and Robinson, who has a chance to stick as a third big like into the future?
I mean, it feels like they're leaning Robinson because they kept him in, right? And
you'd think that, although they had Robinson first, like Robinson was just like available. When they first signed Robinson to his 10 days and stuff like that, Castleton was under contract elsewhere. And then Castleton became available. And then, like, I don't know, it's been mixed signals because they've started one or the other sometimes, and Castleton's played a little bit of four, which I don't think is, you know, I don't think there's a lot of that.
That was because they had to.
Yes. And also, like, wink, wink, they were not trying to play the best lineup possible there.
I think Robinson's gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
He's made the most of this opportunity.
Yeah, he's certainly gotten more comfortable with the passing and some of the DHO stuff they have their bigs do. You know, still probably, you know, good, decent instincts defensively, but I don't know if he has the burst to be like a true rim protector.
I mean, I think Castleton has a higher ceiling.
Yeah.
He's just like a little more athletic and skilled.
Yeah, and probably I like the shot a little bit better, even though he has a smaller diet, sample.
That's what I mean, like skilled, like he can pass and handle and shoot, has a better touch. So I don't know.
So we'll see. We'll find out tomorrow. But what this also means is that they're extremely shorthanded tonight because they have two open roster spots. RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly will rest. Jakob Poeltl and Jacoby Walter are still out with the finger and the hip, respectively. And Brandon Ingram, Grady Dick, Oliver Tshiebwe are done for the season. And Jared Roden's questionable.
So what does that leave us?
I mean, Chris Boucher, I know they don't want to play him because it's unfair to him after a couple weeks down or whatever. But I think if Jared Roden's out, Boucher would be the eighth or ninth man tonight.
You know what it means? Him.
A lot of Garrett Temple minutes.
Oh, yeah. We'll see how he's feeling after. He's had, 2 days off, though, right? 2 days off after
No, they played Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Man, at the age of 47, one day off, and then you got to play again? We'll see how he feels.
Yeah, I mean, he said the other day he wants to come back as a player. So so let's see it, Garrett.
I'm all for that. Play as long as you can. Play till the wheels come off. Play till they kick you out of the league. Because remember we talked about it. I'm like, once it's over, that's it.
Yeah,
it's
there's over. No, like we talked about with Capone too, even him trying to come back with the Warriors after taking time off or whatever.
Once you stop, that's a wrap once you get at that age.
The other thing of note, there aren't a lot of like statistical milestones guys are chasing or anything like that. Because Chris Boucher got shelved, he was on track to crack the top 10 all time in Raptors games played, which would have been cool. That hasn't played out. Michael Grange had a good piece talking to Boucher about his situation the other day. Jamison Battle is not going to beat your mark for 3-point shooting.
How do you know?
He's down to, well, he would have to get like really hot over these.
It's
last
possible.
What he could do though, he needs 5 threes to match Andrea Bargnani for second most threes ever by a Raptors rookie by volume. He's not going to get you for percentage, but he's cleared everyone except for Bargnani and Dame and Stoudemire so far. He's not touching Dame.
I don't like
Damon.
The volume comparisons because it's apples to oranges.
Yeah, I agree with
it's
that.
It's a different era.
And although what it does really highlight, though, is how crazy Damon Stoudemire's rookie season was, because that was 30 years ago, and he's still first by far.
Really?
That's
incredible.
He had 133 three-pointers as a rookie in 70 games, and no one else has more than 100 in Raptors history.
He was ahead of his time.
Way ahead of his time.
He can shoot it.
Yeah,
I played when the Final Four came to San Antonio last time. I want to say like 2019, maybe 18. We did a charity game, and he played in it, and nice. He was still canning threes.
Yeah. He shot almost 40% as a rookie, too.
Yeah.
Like, on almost 5 attempts a game. In 1995, that's like, fairly unheard of at that point in time.
He's another guy that came on the Spurs right at the end of his career as a vet.
Oh, yeah. He did 31 games.
Yep.
In 2007, 2008. Was that your second year there? First year?
Second year, I think. Yeah. Second year.
Nice. That's you got to play with everyone, man.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, that's great. That's you guys went to the conference finals.
They would always bring in like these vet guys for like 10 days. Like Austin Crozier played with us at the very end of his career on a 10-day, which was really cool for me. Like when I went to Providence, he hosted my visit and was a guy like when I was growing up, I really watched and like looked up to playing for the Friars. So that was cool.
Nice. The Friars. What a good team name, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Catholic school.
We got a couple. We're going to talk to Tim Cato. We're going to get the state of the Mavericks on the other side here. We just talked about some of the fringe guys, and we did the young guys the other day. When you look at the core pieces here, and let's start with Scotty Barnes just because he's the most important player on the team. What do you, if you were going to snapshot his season and, you know, kind of what you're looking for when he comes back next year to take that next step, what would that be?
You know what the obvious thing is, 3-point shooting, like getting more consistent. He had a great 3-point shooting night last game, but getting more consistent, more of a threat from there. You know, Would it be great if you could stick to catch and shoot rhythm threes? Yeah. But if you're going to be, I mean, he is a star in this league, but you got to be able to like knock down open threes in more than one situation consistently. I would just be shooting threes, mm-hmm. catch and shoot, on walk up on the dribble, pick and pop, pulling to the corner, pulling to the top, repositioning, going from, you know, corner, we call it shake on the Spurs, corner to wing. But just all the different ways you get threes in an NBA game. I don't think he's a guy that needs to shoot unless he's open, because mm-hmm. he does so many other things, and like that's not what he needs to do. But when you're open, just get consistent in these different situations, knocking down the three. That's kind of obvious when you look at his shooting percentages and his struggles throughout the year.
And what his usage could look like when Brandon Ingram's in the mix as well, right? Like, Scottie's probably going to – I mean, he's still going to have the ball in his hands a lot, but he probably won't have to self-create threes that much. He'll get a few more
exactly. That's what I'm saying. You don't need – that's what I mean. You don't need to work on creating your own three, but just in these situations when the ball gets swung to you and you're open, being able to shoot and make it consistently. The good thing with him, I like his shot. Mm-hmm. Like, it has good arc rotation. I like his release. It's not like a Jeremy Sochan situation where you are like – he looks like Chuck Hayes. Remember when he just would get the lane violations because he had that hitch in his shot? Like, he has great mechanics. I totally think he will eventually be a consistent three-point shooter. But, yeah, that's something you got to work on to get to.
Okay, I think I know your answer for this one, but what about Emmanuel Quickly?
What do you mean you think you know?
I think I know what you're going to suggest he needs to get better at.
The floater?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would watch Darius Garland tape.
It's great.
And be
great.
Like... all right, let me work on that. He's an incredible shooter. You know, Quickly is an incredible shooter off the dribble. He's got incredible range. He can shoot 3-4 feet behind the three-point line. Running full speed, leading the break. You don't pick me up, bam, I'm stopping, I'm popping. That's a good shot for him. He's probably one of the only guys on the team that has that. He's gotten way better passing and making decisions, hitting the roll guy and pick and rolls since he's gotten here, and that I thought that took another step forward this season, which is a huge part of being a point guard, you know. I was just watching his dance and it threw me off.
Me too.
I like it. I might have to break that out.
Okay. You're gonna do
this. I'm going next time I'm at the park and I hit a three, I'm gonna do the Quickly
back down
the Quickly dance. Nice. Skip down the court. Earn some cool points. But yeah, I think with his size and He's like athletic, but it's not like he's a freak athlete who's gonna like Jamal Shedd when he goes to the hoop.
Yeah,
he can dunk it or explode to the hoop and physically use his body to finish. He doesn't really have that. So like, how are you finishing when you get in the paint and you have to finish? The floater, I think, is a great option for him. Most guys who are good at shooting are good at floaters. Mm-hmm. It's like the same mechanics. It means you have the same eye-hand coordination, same touch. You just got to work on kind of converting that to the floater. And like I said, Darius Garland's a good comp. Darius Garland isn't athletically or physically finishing on anyone in the paint. But when he gets in the paint, if you don't commit to him, it's a bucket. Mm-hmm. And most of that is because of that floater. It's unstoppable. So I think for me, like if I'm evaluating myself, that would be what I would be working on. I want that to be deadly.
It's also interesting, if you look at the guys who are really good at floaters, Garland, when he plays alongside Allen or Mobley, Trey Young's really good at it when he plays alongside Capella or Kongwu. If you look at, like, let's play out the scenario. I know people were a little down on him after the Final Four game, but let's play out the scenario where the Raptors end up with Kaman Malawach out of Duke, a huge lob threat. Having that floater...
it's the same mechanics.
And it's very tricky for the defense. Like someone on, I forget who it was, maybe Steph Noe, who came on with us, had a thing on Twitter earlier in the year where he would play clips of Trae Young and Capella and then freeze frame it. And you were supposed to guess if it was a floater shot or a lob pass. And like people were getting like 50% correct. It's like, that's what it does to a defense. It's like, is this a shot I'm defending? Do I need to get the lob instead? It's a good weapon to open up your passing as well, especially if you start playing with the lob threat at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
And Jakob's obviously a good like paint finishing threat, but he's not like a vertical lob threat in the same way. All right, just for completion, let's hit RJ Quickly. He's obviously had a pretty good season and taken a really nice step forward as a playmaker this year. What would you like to see RJ come back with a little more refined next year?
Maybe like finishing going right.
Okay.
Which is weird to say because he still can seems like he can get to his left anytime he wants, even though everyone in the gym knows that's what he's trying to do and that's what's coming.
To your point, though, he did only finish 62% of his shots at the rim this year, which is like not terrible, but like way down from where it was last year. So in terms of his finishing, he's obviously, again, great season overall. But when it comes to enhancing your finishing package by being a little more ambidextrous, 62% could nudge back up. He was at almost 69% last year.
He had a great year offensively. Yeah. Like, he can do pretty much everything. He can score at all three levels. He's great in the pick and roll. That was nice. He's great. Like, if you need him to play point forward, he's shown he can do that. He had some really high assist games in that role. You know, maybe just some of the decision making when he has to put that hat on with the turnovers. But that's kind of splitting hairs, in my opinion. I thought overall he was really good. I liked his 3-point shooting.
Yes.
He got a nice shot. I like his shot selection with a 3-pointer. You know, we had his trainer, Drew Hanlon, on talking about some of the stuff he wants to work on. Because I'm like, what are you going to work on with him this summer? This is kind of cheating, but that he knows him better than I do. And he was talking about some of the pick and roll stuff, like continuing to improve, making reads out of the pick and roll, when to snake, when to pull up, when to drive it. And he brought up, like, you know, if he gets forced to the right. And I thought he got better as the season went on, but being it, like, if you get forced right, having a finishing package or a move that you can go to.
And not having to do the go back to your left
exactly.
While you're going right.
Which is, you know, not a lot of players have it both ways, you know.
It's like, tough.
I think I made, like, 2 left-hand shots in 12 years. I mean, not that I'm nearly as good as RJ Barrett, but, yeah, it's hard, especially.
You're an NBA player.
Yeah, but at that level. But if he gets that, like, well, then what do you do? I'd say that. And then defensively, just continuing to work on that end of the court, being locked in. And, again, also got really a lot better throughout the season. But seeing, like, all right, what are ways I can impact the game defensively? That would be something, too.
Yeah, I imagine it's a little harder to work on your defense in the offseason.
Like, yeah, I don't know how. Yeah, like, what do you do? Lane slides?
Film and, like, like conditioning stuff, lateral quickness,
Most of it is, like, just mental.
Yeah. Yeah, good luck telling an NBA player in the first couple weeks of the offseason, hey, man, you gotta work on your slides.
I used to do lane slides in the offseason.
But not, like, the first 2 weeks of the offseason, right? You're probably, like, no defensive drills, like.
I do lane slides every workout. It only takes a few minutes.
Yeah.
30-second lane slides. Go. How many? Yeah, I forget how many I could get, or a minute.
Nice.
I don't remember
You just set the clock and see how many times you can get back.
Well, I had a number that I had to get.
Okay.
And I'd work on it, change direction, trying to work on that explosiveness, first step, reaction, speed, so that I can survive in the NBA.
Yeah, and there's no, like, there aren't a lot of exercises that replicate that. Like, you don't move laterally like that in everyday life or in other gym exercises. So I guess you gotta kind of just do it.
Yeah, it's basketball shape. It's basketball muscles.
Yeah.
I always talk about it, like, I can be in the great shape. I am. Like, I can run on the treadmill. I can do the elliptical. I can swim. I can do all these things, but you go play some pickup basketball, you use muscles you don't use doing anything else.
Yeah.
And then you feel it the next day. Those are the muscles you got to keep working.
Yeah. Speaking of bad offseason habits, Luka Doncic. No, I'm kidding. But I am going to use that as a pivot to take a break. Luka returned to Dallas yesterday. Still a lot of drama around all that. More reporting coming out about Nico Harrison. Who did know about this? Who didn't know about this? Why did they get rid of Luka? How bad a mistake it was? Let's take a break. Let's talk to Tim Cato about Luka's return there. Let's talk about a Mavericks team that the Raptors will see tonight and try to play spoiler as the Mavericks try to fight for home court in the play-in tournament. Tim Cato joins us next as the Raptors show continues with Blake Murphy and Matt Bonner.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptors show. Blake Murphy and Matt Bonner with you. The Toronto Raptors are in Dallas tonight for their 81st game of the season. Matters to the Mavericks for play-in jockeying. Does not matter a ton for the Raptors, even in the lotto standings. What did matter a lot down in Dallas was the return of Luka Doncic on Wednesday. Our pal Tim Cato of All City, All DLLS was down there. Tim joins us now. Good morning, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic. I'm going to be 100% honest with you guys. I thought you guys just wanted to talk about Luka. I forgot that it was a Raptors-Mavericks game tonight.
Yeah.
That's how inconsequential it is. I just thought that you guys, you know, I come on and talk every once in a while. I was like, yeah, you guys want the first hand of the Luka game, and I was happy to do that.
Yeah, I do not have a lot of X's and O's notes for Raptors-Mavericks for you. I'm not, hey, who's the toughest check for Najee Marshall as he continues this heater? No, we want to talk Luka. How was the other night? Oh, actually, you know what? Before we talk about the night specifically, has anyone made Jason Kidd aware yet of what happened after the Babe Ruth trade? He like compared the Luka Doncic trade to the Babe Ruth trade, I think not realizing that the Red Sox went like 80 years without cursed. Winning a championship. The curse of the Bambino is a big thing. Has anyone made Jason Kidd aware that's the worst possible comparison you could make for this trade?
Like what are we going to call it? The curse of the Doncino?
Sure.
You know, does that work? Does that have any juice? I believe Jason Kidd was... He has a long encyclopedia, a long list of just baffling, bizarre quotes, and he doesn't take these media things too seriously. I believe I heard that he was referencing some column in the Dallas Morning News, but yeah, I mean it was a preposterous quote, and I don't get it.
You can't compare. You got to wait like 30 years before you can make that comparison.
Yeah. 80, 100 years. Yeah. I don't know. Whatever. You're a Red Sox guy. I forget the exact number of years it was.
It was depressing. It got dark as a Red Sox fan growing up.
Yeah.
That's why when that crazy comeback and we finally won it, I say we, I'm on the team, but
no. And unfortunately,
it was bonkers in New England when that happened.
Yeah. And the curse for the Red Sox fans for a long time. And then for the rest of us, because since then we've heard nothing but Boston sports good things. That 2004 onward, it's been an embarrassment.
We were in a preseason game in Portland when they won it. And I was on the bench and they announced it in the Moda Center or the Rose Garden at the time. And I stood up and I was like, yeah. I remember Sam Mitchell's like, Matt, sit your ass down.
Okay, so regrettable quote from Jason Kidd. Regrettable situation overall, Tim. I know you were talking to a lot of fans leading up to that one. You posted some pictures on social of the signs people had and stuff like that. Can you take us through a little bit of the emotion of that night, both, you know, for yourself, for fans, for Luka Doncic?
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented. This is a situation that, you know, you really do have to go back to the Red Sox. There's a reason that people are comparing it to a trade from 100 years ago, because there is no precedent of it in American sports history, and really all sports history, since trading players is a very American, North American thing. And I guess the thing that I keep thinking about is, you know, all your life, ever since childhood, you're taught that sports are, you know, they teach you life lessons. They teach you, you know, all the positive stuff like teamwork and, you know, respect for the game and hard work and all this stuff. But they teach you heartbreak. You know, every single one of your favorite teams, you know, Matt, the Red Sox up until that moment, you know, they have taught you heartbreak and pain and that things, you know, life's not fair. But this is such a unique situation where it's like, this just didn't have to happen. In no scenario did this have to happen like this. This is not a precedent in trade, which means that, you know, like Luka so clearly on the night was, you know, it wasn't angry Luka. It wasn't Luka, you know, that we've seen before. It's him, you know, what he was doing on the court with the basketball in his hands was sensational. That was Luka. But, you know, this wasn't someone who was just screaming at, you know, he looks sad. He looks sad that he had to go out there and do that against a team. Like he looked like, you know, if he had it his way and this is the case, this is true. Like he would just rather still be there. You know, and so it's, you know, what I've heard from the fans and what I've, you know, heard leading up to this night. And again, on this night, you know, I think the saddest thing is the fans who, you know, there's a lot of fans who the moment the trade happened, they're like, I'm not going to be a fan of the Mavericks. Like morally, this goes against everything that, you know, all the reasons that I chose to be a Mavericks fans. But I think the saddest story is the people who still want to be Mavericks fans, because that's so, it's such a core part of their identity. And then they watch the team and it's just apathy. They just don't feel the same way. They're not going to go root for anybody else. They're going to follow Luka's career, but you know they can't be a Lakers fan. You know, I've had so many people tell me that like I could never root for the Lakers. I was talking to somebody who was like, you know, I watched a few games of the Spurs, maybe to see if that's something that, you know, if it felt right, and it didn't. You know, some of these people don't know anything other than Mavericks fandom and don't want to know anything else, but they watch the team and it's just not a team that they can support. It's not a team that they're excited to watch, that they're drawn to, and so. You know, when people say that this is, you know, the death of a fandom, it's 100% right. That is 100% what's happening.
You know, there's no way Mavericks fans can become Spurs fans. They literally play a song, Mamas Don't Let Your Kids Grow Up to Be Spurs Fans, during every time when we play them in the arena. Like, they're bred to not, they'll be like a Red Sox fan becoming a Yankees fan. Maybe not that to that degree, but yeah. Similar.
If Johnny Damon could do it.
I don't think he did it, but yeah, this is what a great opportunity. So someone is going to capture everyone's hearts at some point, though. Like, this can't last forever. Someone random, what an opportunity. Someone's going to come along and spark joy in these Mavs fans again. It's just a question of how long will it take.
It might have to be post-Nico at this point, right? Because, like, I mean, look, the fire Nico chants aren't going away. I saw you you share something from in the stadium where a guy has a regular shirt on and then quickly holds up a Nico sucks shirt and the camera has to cut away in stadium. Yeah, I guess the path back to this, and even, like, even if the short-term justification for the trade, which still didn't make any sense, if Nico was going to hang his hat on that in any way, like Kyrie's injury and the fact that the Mavs, you know, just aren't going to figure it out beyond maybe winning one play-in game here, like that path back is probably pretty far down the line at this point, right?
Yeah. A lot of people say that, you know, any chance of their fandom coming back, you know, starts with the people involved in making this decision, at least beneath ownership. Because ownership is, it's basically people are like, let's be realistic. But until Jason Kidd and Nico Harrison, are gone from the roster, and you know, maybe even the representations of the trade. Not that Anthony Davis did anything wrong or ever asked for the situation. Like, this is an unfair situation for him to be in. But you know, I think some fans would have a trouble rooting for him. Not that they would cheer against him. Not that they would wish him, not wish him well. But you know, it's just difficult. You know, everything about the team right now is a reminder of you know what happened, and absolutely, it's you know, it may be years, and when you look at the pick situation that Dallas is in, you know, it may be 5 years, it may be 10 years. You know, it's a really bleak future for Dallas. You know, in the short term, unfortunately, even though I thought the team was going to be decent, you know, if they had been healthy, but now they're not, and Kyrie is. You know, an ACL injury to a small guard, approaching his mid-30s is, you know, a really, really difficult situation. And I he's going to, you know, best case scenario, he's back, you know, maybe around the All-Star break next year. And I don't know how you go into a summer building a team for having a superstar guard and winning enough to make the playoffs for 2/3 of the regular season. And then, you know, but that roster also has to be able to, you know, be ready for theoretically Kyrie's return. It's just everything is very bleak. Here in Dallas.
Yeah. This is more that is depressing. I'm sadder than like an early album Bright Eyes song now. Like
yeah,
that
not
is
as sad
dark.
As we were last night, but it's getting pretty dark. God. Yeah, and
thank
and
God like, I'm not a Mavericks fan.
Yeah, and like I don't know, like Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford are back now, but you wrote a thing the other day that like even with the defensive pieces back, it looks a little awkward. And then like you said, you look ahead to the draft cachet, you look ahead to their offseason maneuverability, and there's just like Kyrie's not getting healthier until the All-Star break. Anthony Davis is not getting younger, and he's not the most durable guy. It's tough.
Did Nico trade Quentin Grimes too?
Yeah.
Whoa, he's on fire.
Yeah, for Caleb Martin. God. Tossed in a second-round pick as well, although I think they ended up kicking one back because medicals or whatever. But, yeah, not a great couple of weeks.
Listen, I got an answer to this problem. Walter Clayton Jr.
There you go.
Let's go.
They do own their pick this year and next year. So, you know, I were in charge of the team, I would really consider just, fire Nico. It's the only way to heal from, for this fan base to start to heal and try to do a rebuild, try to get as much young players. I would probably tear down, try to get as much young players while you have control of your, you know, your draft capital for two seasons, because from 2027 to 2030, Dallas does not own their picks.
That's ugly. That is ugly. Okay, Tim. So this is a great finger on the pulse of how Mavericks fans are feeling. There is another component to this as well, and it's something you wrote about at All DLLS the other day, and I wanted to ask you about. What has the reaction to this been from Slovenian fans who were Mavericks fans because Luka Doncic was a Maverick, but their loyalty is more to Luka Doncic, the individual, than the Mavericks organization?
Yeah, so back in 2019 when I was at The Athletic, I actually went to Slovenia.
I remember that.
For a few days and did a whole story about it then. And periodically, when Luka was a Maverick, I would call up some people that I met on that trip and just kind of check in, usually around big moments, big shots, you know, playoff runs, stuff like that. And, you know, it only felt fitting to do that one more time. And I thought the most interesting thing that I heard, and this comes in the context of, you know, like you said, most Slovenians or all Slovenians are Luka fans. And they're most rooting for Luka, who they view as, you know, they have so much pride in Slovenia. They have so much pride in their people and their country and their culture. But they also realize they're a country of 2 million and that, you know, like on the political global stage, like they're never going to have the influence that, you know, their pride would want them to have. But they have these athletes, and they've had athletes who have always performed far past, you know, what you might think the country would do given its size. And so it's athletes or its ambassadors who go out into the world. And so on one hand, they're kind of excited. Like the Lakers are one of those teams that they know as a brand. They know them as like the Real Madrid of the NBA. And so they're excited for Luka to go to that bigger stage and to represent Slovenia on even higher levels. But I thought the most interesting thing was that there is a sadness that over 7 years, so many of these Luka fans had become, you know, they thought being a Luka fan was, you know, something inseparable from being a Mavericks fan. And they have really considered themselves and grown to be Mavericks fans. You know, I got told stories of how, you know, obviously I was talking to people who were kind of in the sports media landscape in Slovenia and Slovenians who work in sports. And they're surprised when someone who seems like they have the impression that they're just more of a casual fan, when they're mentioning PJ Washington and Derek Lively and how much they love watching those guys, you know, back when they were Luka's teammates. And so it's the sadness, you know, there's a lot of anger at the people who made this decision that they treated Luka in the way that they did. Totally understandable. But there is a little bit of sadness, even though everybody's going to get over it. They're going to keep watching Luka. They're going to adjust to, you know, Luka's new, you know, situation. But there's a sadness that, you know, it had to go down this way. As one person told me, you know, it felt like all the Slovenian fans of Luka got traded to LA too.
That's a great way to put it. And I know, look, geographically, Slovenia to LA is not close, but at least they're familiar with LA because of Andrej Kopitar, who's like the best Slovenian hockey yes. player ever and is a lifelong Los Angeles King. So maybe they can find yes. like some solace and like, okay, LA is the Slovenian outpost for sports now. But I don't know. I'm grasping here. That's a tough one.
I'm told there are Slovenians, like there's a decent population of Slovenians who live in LA as
okay.
well. So it's not as many as Cleveland. I believe Cleveland, I'm not quite sure why, but Cleveland has the most Slovenians not in Slovenia in any city in the world. But yeah, there's a decent number of Slovenians who live in LA as well. As one person, you know, one guy who was, you know, a TV guy, a sports TV guy, he was like, yeah, we were covering the fires in LA because it was an international news story. And that was like kind of the week before the Luka Doncic trade happened. And then Luka got traded, and all of a sudden that was the biggest news. And he was like, we feel bad, you know, like the fires are more important, you know, to people's lives. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, what was kind of like a niche interest story became like the biggest story in the entire country, which was Luka getting traded to that town.
I wonder if the Slovenian community in Cleveland is just like, man, why couldn't our forefathers have picked like San Diego? Yeah. Like, why Cleveland?
Yeah, there's a good, so the my hometown, Tim, Cambridge, Ontario, has a very heavy Portuguese population, and there's a popular Portuguese Instagram reel or TikTok or whatever that has been sent to me a dozen times over the years of like Portuguese people saw this and it's like these beautiful shots of Portuguese islands and stuff and chose Cambridge, Ontario.
Exactly,
instead.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
because Slovenia is beautiful.
Yeah.
Lakes, mountains.
It's like that. It's like the one meme is like girls with the time machine. Yes. Hello, I am your daughter. Guys with the time machine. Do not settle in Ontario.
Yeah.
Pick anywhere else.
Yeah.
Luca, Miami, Florida.
Luca's not going to the Cavs. I've
not heard of it yet, but trust me, it's a beautiful place. Please reconsider, forefathers.
Tim, we got you for like a minute before we let you go here. Meaningful at all tonight for the Mavs to get the win and try to wrestle home court from the Kings, or is this like so fait accompli that they're going to get bounced in the second play-in game that it's not a big concern?
It probably doesn't matter, but it's the team's stated goal to get the best seed possible, which is they've got one option now. They've got, you know, they don't control it, but theoretically a win help gets them closer to the goal, the stated goal that the team has. And so in that context, then yeah, Dallas is going to be going for a win.
Cool. Doesn't matter almost at all to the Raptors, and they're going to have like seven guys. So best of luck to the Mavs.
AJ Lawson revenge game.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. He's got a he had the second highest scoring game ever for a player on a two-way contract a couple weeks back. He's going for first year. Alec Peters of the Phoenix Suns, your 36 points are in trouble tonight against AJ Lawson.
Man, can't wait to see it. History is going to be.
You'll have to take it off his Wikipedia page.
Yeah, there you go. Whoever's updating Alec Peters' Wikipedia page. Tim, thanks so much for doing this, man.
It's Alec Peters.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, man. Really appreciate you doing this.
Thanks, Tim.
See y'all.
Tim Cato of the All-NBA Network and the All-DLLS podcast, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts, and a lot of his great writing work up at All-DLLS. Alec Peters, by the way, playing for Olympiakos now. He has been naturalized as a Bosnian player, even though he's American. So, little Alec Peters fact for you.
What's his connection to Bosnia?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
You better have one.
I bet it's more tenuous than Lorenzo Brown being Spanish now.
This is
Raptors 905, listen, former G League MVP.
Every time I hear a story like this, I get a pang of anger.
Because you couldn't get
naturalized
here? Because
I couldn't get my Canadian passport.
Yeah.
Back in like 09 or whatever.
Yeah, and
I had a grandfather from Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Like,
I remember being very mad about that at the time, and yep. I'm still mad about it for you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Time now for Fast Break, brought to you by BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. It is Raptors at Mavericks at 8:30 tonight. The Mavericks are 12.5 point favorites with an over-under of 224.5. And here's the, I guess, only notable thing. If you were betting on Raptors win totals before the season, most of the lines were 30.5. Some of them are 29.5. Some of them are 31.5. But the Raptors are sitting at 30 wins. So I'd imagine there are some people who bet these preseason win totals who are pretty invested in these last two Raptors games in one direction or the other. If you look at the Raptors injury report, Jared Roden is questionable. He has a right shoulder sprain he suffered while putting up a beast stat line the other game. RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley will rest. Jakob Poeltl and Jacoby Walter remain out with their finger and hip issue, respectively. Grady Dick, Brandon Ingram, Mahler, Tchamshe remain out for the season. On the Mavs side, Anthony Davis is probable. Klay Thompson, Spencer Dinwiddie, Dante Exum, and Jaden Hardy, the unknown Hardy boy, Matt Bonner, they are all questionable. Kyrie Irving, Olivier Max-Prosper, Kessler Edwards, and Kai Jones are all out. Kessler Edwards and Kai Jones because the Mavericks have run out of two-way days because they were almost out of players for a good chunk of the season. To reset the stakes, Mavericks are 38-42. They've dropped three in a row. They are 5-3 when Anthony Davis plays at least. And yeah, they're 10th, trying to chase the Kings for 9th so they can host that 9-10 play-in game. On the Raptors side, the only other thing of note, if they use a new starting lineup tonight, they will set a new franchise record with their 39th different starting lineup
of
the year.
Like a G League coach.
They are 38 right now, which ties the Tampa Tank season. New starting lineup tonight. We got a new record. And then on Monday, we'll break down our top 39 Raptors starting lineups of the season.
Oh,
1 through 39.
I can't wait to start researching that.
That will be not what we're doing on Monday. It's locker cleanout day on Monday. We'll probably hear from a bunch of the Raptors.
Cubicle cleanout for us.
Yeah, not for me.
Well, not for you.
I just changed my hat. Literally and figuratively. Okay, that's it for today. That was Fast Break, brought to you by BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. Thanks to Tim Cato for joining us, to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and James Wilson behind the glass. It's Raptors Mavs tonight. It's Raptors Spurs on Sunday to close out the season. We'll be back on Monday again. It's locker cleanout day, so hopefully we'll hear from some of the Raptors. We'll put a bow on the season. Matt, have a terrific weekend.
You too.
All right, we'll talk to you guys Monday. Have a wonderful weekend. Go Raptors.